This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schneeb is brilliant, and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. That's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Of the dustbin of history. I'm your janitor and custodian, Max Schmid. On today's program, well, the regular lineup. Chapter 2 of Face of the Foe from the Zero Hour, produced by Elliot Lewis and your host, Rod Serling. Chapter 3 of 6 parts from the CBC of The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin from Vanishing Point series from 1987. And we'll wrap it up, as ever, with Gene Shepard, another never-before-rebroadcast episode about quarks and fistfights in the Army from, September of 1969. So that's our lineup. And we begin with the Hollywood Radio Theater, from the recorded right off the New York run on WRVR on November 13th, 1973. It's The Face of the Foe, episode number 2. It's about a serial killer and the custodian, the mild Mr. Matry. In our cast, Jessica Walter as Nicole, Joseph Campanella as Chris, and Judy Karn as Laura, with, oh, Alice Reinhardt, Don Diamond, and the likes. Old-time radio actors. So let's hear it now. 0 Hour, episode number 2 of 5 of The Face of the Foe, here in the Dustbin of History on WBAI New York.
Hollywood Radio Theater. Every day at this time, Monday through Friday, a J.M. Colas Enterprises production, the Hollywood Radio Theater, presents an unusual tale of mystery and suspense. Every week, Monday through Friday, the Hollywood Radio Theater presents...
Good evening. You're listening to The 0 Hour. Rest your eyes. Exercise your imagination. This week, Patricia Powers' eerie saga, The Neighborhood Besieged. Face of the Foe. Starring Jessica Walter, Joseph Campanella, and Judy Karn in Elliot Lewis's production of The 0 Hour.
Ordinarily, the greatest winter concern for Montreal residents is hockey. But this is no ordinary winter in Montreal. Only the climate is as usual, and Canadians have learned to deal with inclement weather. But in one particular neighborhood, there's something outside more terrible than snow. Or so it would seem to young Nicole Nugent. She enlisted the company of the gentle-mannered janitor of her building to join her in walking an hysterical woman, one Kathleen Windsor, safely home. Seeing the middle-aged woman's plush apartment and frilly little girl bedroom, and having witnessed her flirtatious manner with her male escort, Nicole concludes that the shadowy pursuer that Miss Windsor claimed was following her home in the night was merely the product of a lonely spinster's fertile imagination. But now, Kathleen Windsor is dead. And for Nicole Nugent, a story in the newspaper lends credence to the theory that there is a fiend on the loose, and he's somewhere, very close by. Face of the Foe will continue after this word.
You can win a Pioneer R700 three-way speaker system valued at over $460 in FM Guide's Pioneer Sweepstakes. The R700 is a culmination of over 6 years of intensive research. Pioneer and FM Guide, the monthly music magazine, which brings you the most complete listings of Greater New York Station's FM radio programming, plus music and hi-fi editorial, are offering you this chance to win this superior speaker system. It's as easy as listening to your favorite FM station. Just pick up a copy of FM Guide's November issue at any newsstand. Write your name and address on the cover or a reasonable facsimile and mail it to FM Guide Pioneer Sweepstakes, 1290 6th Avenue, New York 10019. You'll enjoy FM Guide and you'll be hearing better with the Pioneer R700 speaker system. That's FM Guide Pioneer Sweepstakes, 1290 6th Avenue, New York 10019. Do it today. You could be the winner.
Maybe the man who killed her was someone else, someone she knew.
Why do you say that?
Well, how did he get in? She wouldn't open a door to a stranger, would she? Especially if she had really just escaped from a man following her.
Chris is right, Nicky. It doesn't make sense. It must have been someone she knew.
Which means it doesn't have anything to do with you and what happened last night. So try to put the whole thing out of your mind.
I'll fix us all a drink.
And then I'm going to say goodnight, Buffett. Let you put that poor stuffy head of yours to bed.
Bed was one thing, but sleep was another. My head began to throb. I didn't know whether it was from my cold or the image I couldn't keep out of my mind. Kathleen Windsor, with her little girl curls and big blue please-like-me eyes, lying lifeless beneath the ruffled canopy of her four-poster bed, under the sightless glass-button stare of the giant plush teddy bear in the corner. The sudden ring of the telephone startled me. Laura was evidently sleeping too soundly to hear it. Lucky Laura. Hello?
Miss Prescott.
No, this isn't...
Where is she?
Who is this?
Is she out with a boyfriend?
Who is this calling?
I'll call again.
Who was that, I wondered? As far as I knew, Laura had no man in her life. And the man on the phone, whoever he was, sounded like someone she wouldn't want to have in it. In the morning, I mentioned what happened.
Norman Roxburgh. I'm sure that's who it was. Holy, what a nerve. Calling and asking questions about my business. As if he had a right to know.
Who is he?
Oh, just someone in my restaurant administration class. Just hang up on him if he calls again. Hey, your cold sounds a little better. How do you feel?
My cold's better. I'm worse. The ache has gone down into my bones.
Well, that sounds like the flu. Better spend another day bundled up by the fire.
I'll have to. I'm not good for anything else. Between flu bugs and your telephone Lothario, not to mention murder, I didn't get much sleep last night.
Well, it's Sunday. You can sleep all day.
But it seemed I'd barely gotten settled on the sofa and begun to drowse off when Laura gently shook me awake.
Sorry, Nicky, but I'm afraid you're going to have company.
Oh, no. Who?
Your Aunt Emily. She just phoned. I tried to put her off, but you know your Aunt Emily.
I wouldn't trade my Aunt Emily for a round dozen of anybody else's aunts. Granted, she was a little eccentric. Some people might even say crazy. The truth of the matter was, she was just gloriously herself. A blithe spirit. Unfortunately, though I was only 24 and she was close to 70, just listening to Aunt Emily took more energy than I was up to in my present condition.
You sound like a frog, dear. But never mind. They turn into princes, you know.
As bad as I felt, I had to admit the sight of Aunt Emily was like a spring tonic. Lately, she'd been attending Sunday feasts at the Park Avenue Hare Krishna Temple. She loved the food, the incense, the dancing, the hand clapping, and she generally dropped in at our apartment afterward, swathed in a sheet, with tilax painted on her forehead and 108 Japa prayer beads adorning her scrawny neck. Today, however, she'd just come from her regular attendance at St. Simon's Church, for which she wore the slightly more conventional attire of a jaunty bright wool cape over knickers and argyle knee socks.
Laura, do you suppose I could have a drop or two of brandy?
Of course, we'll all have some. Be good for Nicky's cold.
I had some shocking news at church today, and I'm quite unstrung.
What news, Aunt Emily?
Murder! The second member of our church choir in a week. First Elsie, and now Kathleen.
Kathleen Windsor sang in the choir at your church?
And now she's been strangled by someone, the same as Elsie was. And both of them on Winnicott Road, where I live.
Oh, Aunt Emily.
I know, it's a bit unnerving. Everybody in the choir warned me to be careful. But I told them no one would bother killing an old woman like me.
Neither of the murderer's two victims were old or young. Both middle-aged, for whatever that might mean.
Well, the fact is, I've been getting some strange vibes from Kathleen lately.
What do you mean, vibes?
She just wasn't herself. She was usually so quiet and subdued. A good little girl, as her mother would say. But these past few weeks, something had really turned her on. She started acting all nervous and giggly.
Probably because her mother was away in the hospital. She felt free for a change.
That must have been it. I can't think of anything else it could be.
You don't suppose she could have found a boyfriend?
Heavens, no. Kathleen was deathly afraid of men.
Only what, Aunt Emily?
I remember one Sunday a month or so ago, just after her mother went into the hospital. Kathleen didn't stay after church for choir practice.
Was that unusual?
Very. She never missed choir practice. And as it happened, I had to skip that Sunday, too, because of a cold. I had a throat as froggy as yours, Nikki. No good for singing.
So what happened, Aunt Emily?
Well, I was walking home, and about a block away from church, I could swear I saw Kathleen Windsor in a car with a man.
If you've ever driven over the 59th Street Bridge late at night and found yourself gently smiling at the warm, delicious, fresh aroma of freshly baked bread, thank Silver Cup Bakers. In the quiet, private hours of the morning, the Silver Cup Bakers perform their honored ritual of baking the finest bread you can buy. Silver Cup, wholesome bread, pure, tasty loaves, nothing artificial. Don't let your nose have all the fun. Buy a fresh loaf of Silver Cup bread and give your taste a treat you didn't think was around anymore. Some things are as good as they used to be. Silver Cup bread is one of them.
This is Van Jay. Hey, these cats have been trying to get me to say some funny things so that you'll listen to my show. But I'm not going to do it. You'll just have to listen because you love it. Midnight to 6 on RVR.
This whole business is just another reminder that we should all live life to the fullest while we're here. So hurry and get rid of that cold, Nikki, and give that man of yours a kiss for me when you see him.
I will, Aunt Emily.
Don't disturb yourselves, dears. I'll see myself out. Oh, he wore flowing robes and sandals, and he came with love for all.
With a flourish of her cape, she pirouetted across the room and was gone. I was glad it was winter. With the streets frozen over with snow and sleet, Aunt Emily had temporarily stored away her favorite mode of transportation, a gleaming red motorcycle. I spent the rest of Sunday catching snatches of fevered sleep. Monday morning, I felt slightly more human, but not quite up to my job as secretary to the principal of Kensington School for Girls. When Laura left for work, I called in sick and went through my ritual of lighting the fire in the living room, bringing a blanket and Kleenex in from the bedroom, and curling up on the sofa again. I didn't stay curled up long.
Forgive me, mademoiselle, but I am Detective Lieutenant Noel Philippe from Homicide.
Homicide?
You are Mademoiselle Nugent, are you not?
Yes, I am, but...
Then you're the person I've come to see. May I come in?
Yes, of course. I don't understand.
I wish to question you about Kathleen Windsor, the woman who was murdered. You knew her, did you not?
No, not really. I mean, I only met her once, briefly.
Briefly or not, mademoiselle, according to the information I've been given, you were one of the last persons to see Kathleen Windsor alive. You and Monsieur Georges Montreuil.
Yes, that's true. But how did you...
Apparently, you didn't consider such a fact of sufficient importance to inform the police?
I'm sorry. I suppose I should have.
Yes, mademoiselle, you should have. We cannot apprehend killers when the public will not cooperate with us.
Maybe they're afraid to get involved. Afraid of the police.
We are all afraid of the police, mademoiselle, because we are all guilty. But now I think you and I must have our little conversation, tardy though it may be.
Lieutenant Philippe was of medium height with a weary face and bleak gray eyes that looked as though they'd seen too much of the seamy side of life. He looked like a tired bloodhound as he trailed me into the living room and sank heavily into the chair by the fire.
Please tell me everything that happened when Miss Windsor came here last Friday night. Do not omit anything, no matter how trivial it may seem.
Lieutenant?
Yes, mademoiselle?
The two murders on Winnicott Road, do you think the same person committed them both?
It is too soon to draw such conclusions. A psychopath may read of a murder in the paper, and his feverish brain is inspired to duplicate the act. Thus, one murder often leads to another.
What a terrible thought.
In the two incidents on Winnicott Road, there is the similarity in the method of murder, strangulation. But there is also an important difference. The Grunberger woman had not been sexually molested. The Windsor woman was. Of course, in the Grunberger case, the killer may have intended to molest his victim, but did not have the time. The car in the garage was running, and he knew the owner might return at any moment.
It's all too terrible to think about.
Yes, murder is never pleasant to contemplate, mademoiselle. But in the event of two murders of women in your immediate vicinity, I suggest you must give it some thought,
Yes, we will. We'll be careful.
There is sometimes a sexual element in murders by strangulation. We may be dealing with a sexual deviant.
Have you talked to Mr. Matry, Lieutenant? Perhaps he might remember something I've forgotten.
I was wondering when you would think to bring up Monsieur Matry. He was, after all, the only other known person to be with Kathleen Windsor just before her death.
He's a very nice man, Lieutenant. I'm sure you'd find him most obliging.
I'm afraid, Mademoiselle Nugent, at this moment we do not find him so. Mr. Matry, it seems, has disappeared before we could question him.
Disappeared?
Tell me what you know of the man.
Not very much, I suppose. I've lived here a year, and he's always been very polite and helpful.
And that is why you thought of him to accompany you and Miss Windsor to her home, is that correct?
Yes. And also, I remembered his telling me once that he liked to take walks at night.
Ah.
But, Lieutenant, that doesn't mean he walked around murdering women.
Oh, perhaps not. Perhaps not. But then, what reason do you suggest he had for not wanting to be questioned by the police?
A very good one, as a matter of fact. I'm thinking of a conversation I had with him last summer. He was working outside in the garden, and I was admiring the flowers he planted. He told me then how he had fled from Hungary in the 1956 revolution, how terrible it was there for his family and himself. He was so thankful to be living here in Montreal.
Yes, that's very interesting.
Well, don't you see? No wonder he ran away from the police. He was afraid from his past experiences.
A sound enough theory, perhaps, mademoiselle. Except for one thing.
What is that, Lieutenant?
I'm afraid we have uncovered another reason for his fear of the police. The record shows that your nice, quiet Monsieur Matry has actually served two terms in prison.
What for?
For molesting women, mademoiselle.
Shock?
Just a one-minute reminder from Sterling Manhattan Cable Television that in music, the future is here, and in television, the future is cable.
Saturday, 17:30 p.m. WRBR, the National Lampoon Radio. Stick it in your ear every Saturday night. The first radio show from the madmen who bring you the world's most widely read humor magazine, the National Lampoon Radio Hour, featuring Lampoon editors Michael O'Donohue, Henry Beard, Brian McConaughey, Sean Kelly, P.J. O'Rourke, George Cho, and other members of the wackiest crew ever assembled. The National Lampoon Radio Hour. Warning, anyone easily offended should take long bus trips without a radio every Saturday night.
The most puzzling aspect of the Kathleen Windsor murder is how the killer got into her apartment. There was no sign of forced entry,
which leads to the obvious conclusion that she willingly opened the door to whomever it was.
And do you think it might have been George Matry?
He had witnessed the type of woman she was and knew that she was alone in her apartment. He could very easily have returned and gained admittance on the pretext that he wanted to be certain everything was all right.
And do you think she would have let him in?
Mademoiselle, have you not been insisting all along that he was not the type that anyone would take to be a murderer?
Lieutenant Philippe had made his point. He lifted himself wearily out of his chair, reclaimed his battered hat, and left me with the information that a man would be stationed at our building in the event that George Matry returned. When I finally crawled back into my cocoon by the fire, I was again, this time from the cold. Late Chris chose just the right moment to cheer me up with a phone call.
Stop trying to blame yourself, Muffet. You had no way of knowing about Mr. Matry. Maybe he isn't a murderer. Maybe he's just a sweet little dirty old man.
Oh, Chris, I'm so glad you called.
I figured you might need a little cheering up. And how about continuing the treatment with a night out this Friday, if you're feeling okay by then?
If I'm not okay by then, I'll never be.
Guy and Lisa have invited us to a play and a buffet supper at their place afterward.
Sounds like the perfect cure for a shut-in. What's the play about?
Oh, something written by a friend of Guy's, a comedy.
Just as long as it isn't a murder mystery. Even if the play were disappointing, an evening with Lisa and one of her buffet suppers could never be. She was a friend from my school days, and Chris had become as good as I was. Lisa had met and married Guy Sabourin less than ago. Unfortunately, neither Chris nor I liked the man, but we'd learned to tolerate him for Lisa's sake. At the moment, I found myself thinking I was going to have to get well by Friday night if I were going to stomach a whole evening in Guy Sabourin's company. Hello?
Aunt Emily, Nicky. How are you feeling?
Oh, getting better. And you?
Splendid. Nicky, I was wondering, do you suppose Laura will be willing to bake a birthday cake for me? I'd pay her for the ingredients, of course. Laura makes such beautiful cakes. And Donald, such a nice boy. So much soul.
Oh, I'm sure Laura would love to, Aunt Emily. But who is Donald?
Donald Hamill. I got him from the drop-in center.
Drop-in center?
For you, unbelievably. He comes from Windsor. Couldn't stand it at home and ran away. Says he won't go back again, and I don't blame him from what he tells me.
Aunt Emily, you didn't...
Bring him home with me? Well, of course I did. Where else was there for the poor boy to go? I'm going to keep him with me until he finds a job and can look after himself.
Aunt Emily, I don't think it's very wise of you to take in some strange boy like that.
Oh, Donald isn't strange. He's a very good boy. Awfully quiet and shy, but not sullen like Tony. Now, you're right about Tony. He is a strange boy, and I'm not so sure I should have let him come home with me.
Who is Tony, Aunt Emily?
Tony Bartha, Donald's friend. Although I wonder if he really is. I know for a fact Tony's going steady with Mary Jane, and I'm afraid he has Donald flirting with her.
Mary Jane? Is that someone else you've brought home with you?
Oh, dear, no. Mary Jane is marijuana, dear.
You mean Tony Bartha's into drugs? Oh, Aunt Emily, I don't think you should let him stay with you.
Don't worry. I'm not going to for long. I don't like his attitude. Cheers!
The rest of the day passed uneventfully, except for another encounter with T. Oliphant when I went to the lobby to get the mail. I was wearing a cable-knit sweater and my oldest pair of corduroy slacks for warmth, and T. Oliphant looked me up and down in the same manner that he had Kathleen Windsor. A new thought occurred to me. Maybe he just didn't approve of women wearing pants. I scuttled past him quickly and hurried back to the sheltering circle of my fire like primitive man huddling against evil spirits. A few moments later, I had fallen sound asleep. It was dark in the room when I woke up. Laura had her class on Monday nights and didn't come home for dinner. The room was chilly. I put more wood on the fire and turned on the lamp. I thought of all the things I needed to do before I left on my trip to Jamaica. Clothes to sew, laundry to do, Christmas presents to wrap. I still didn't have the energy. I picked up a book to read, making certain it wasn't the one I'd been reading the night Kathleen Windsor had come pounding on my door. Laura came in so quietly I didn't hear her. I gave a start when she suddenly materialized beside me. She looked strange. her face pale, her eyes staring. Laura, is something wrong?
There's someone with me, Nicky. May I ask him in?
Of course. She walked to the hall and in a moment returned with a man at her side. Pleasant looking, sensitive features, with dark blonde hair that just brushed the collar of his expensively tailored suit.
Mr. Brooke, this is my roommate, Nicole Nugent. Nicky, this is Julian Brooke.
How do you do?
I'm pleased to meet you, Mr. Brooke. Laura, what's wrong? Something is, I can tell.
I'm afraid Miss Prescott doesn't feel yet like talking about it, Miss Nugent. You see, she's just had a ruddy bad scare.
Laura, what happened?
A man attacked her on the street. Tried to drag her off into the park.
Got to get out of this city of night. Find me, oh, find me, my city of light.
Lafayette Radio is one of the largest audio manufacturers. We've been in business more years than Sony. We make more speakers than KLH and more four-channel amplifiers than Fisher and Pioneer combined. But Lafayette is also one of the largest retailers, so we can cut out the middleman other manufacturers need and pass the savings on to you. For example, we sell a Pioneer 8-track AM-FM stereo for $269.95, and we sell a lot of them. But we also sell a comparable Lafayette unit for $179.95, $90 less. We sell a lot of them, too. And in case you think we make our prices look good by jacking up Pioneer's prices, listen to this. Lafayette guarantees any electronic equipment we sell can't be bought for less. Because if you do see it for less, return it within 30 days after purchase and we'll return your money. Lafayette, listen to us. You can't go wrong.
Tomorrow at this time, rest your eyes and listen here to this week's continuing study in suspense. Face of the Foe. I'm Rod Serling. And this is The Zero Hour.
You've been listening to the Hollywood Radio Theater's presentation of The Zero Hour. Heard every weekday at this time. Rod Serling is your host. Patricia Powers, Face of the Foe, was adapted for radio by Shirley Gordon. Jessica Walter is Nicole. Joseph Campanella is Chris. And Judy Karn is Laura. Featured in the cast are Lorene Tuttle as Emily, Shep Mencken as Philippe, and Richard Dawson as Julian. Zero Hour is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Jack Myers is executive producer. Rochelle Sherman, associate producer. And Kim Weisskopf, story editor. Music composed and conducted by Stanley D. Hoffman. The Hollywood Radio Theater theme was played by Ferranti and Teicher and is now available on United Artists Records and Tapes. This has been a J.M. Colas Enterprises production. Hugh Douglas speaking. Tune in tomorrow and once again...
rest your eyes and listen here...
to The Zero Hour.
And we will hear the third episode of Face of the Foe from The Zero Hour on next week's program. The program being The Dustbin of History. Thank you for stumbling in. I'm your janitor, Max Schmied. And up next, episode number 3 of The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin from The Vanishing Point, a Canadian production, originally broadcast on June 19th, 1987. I'd tell you the name of the cast, but it wouldn't mean anything to you. Apparently, a famous Canadian announcer, Ken Haslam, is your announcer on the show. But what more need I say? Not much. Chapter 3 of The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin here in the Dustbin of History on WBAI New York.
The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin. Free love, terrible poverty. Such strange ideas people on Eurus had about the anarchist planet Anaris. Shevik told them the truth. The most brilliant scientist of his time had to admit he had grown up to find he had no place among his comrades. Now, the rich life on Eurus was beginning to tempt him.
All right, little friend. Third simultaneity matrix. Add Y to the 10th power.
That cannot be done. Speed of light barrier cannot be crossed.
Yes, it can.
I've got your bags all packed, sir.
My bags?
Yes, sir. For the weekend.
What?
Country. To visit Dr. Sayo.
Damn! I'd completely forgotten. Thank you, E4.
Mr. Shevek, I was wondering, I have a wife in Capital City. Might I go visit her while you're away, sir?
You don't need my permission to visit your wife. Listen, we have this big apartment, just the two of us. Why don't you ask your wife to stay with us?
Oh, thank you, sir, but I couldn't do that. The university is only for men. Women aren't allowed on the campus.
Well, that's just a silly rule, E4. I'm sure if I...
Ah! There's Dr. Sayo. Have a nice weekend, sir.
Will that be all, Madam Dreer?
Yes. Well, unless our guest would like to relent and try some roast stag.
No, thank you. These vegetables are wonderful and more than enough for me.
Oh, too bad. We hunted down this stag right here on the estate, butchered and aged him ourselves.
Your home is amazing. It looks like one of those ancient castles in our history books.
This is just our country place. Been in my family for 9 generations.
Abenay is the major city of Anaris. In all of Abenay, there is not a building as large as this country place of yours.
Don't you have a house, Dr. Shevek?
My partner and I have a room. Pilon, the baby, is still with us. She sleeps on the platform below ours. Sadik, the older daughter, sleeps in the dorm. She's 9.
But you have no privacy. Well, how do people carry on love affairs?
Dreer?
Well, I was only wondering. And everybody seems to be living on top of each other on Anaris. It sounds like a prison.
We have no policemen on Anaris.
What keeps people from robbing and murdering each other?
Nobody needs to steal. If you want something, you simply go to the depository and take it.
Oh.
As for violence, why would you murder me if you could gain no advantage from my death?
Oh.
Air raid drill. It's this stupid rebellion on the outer planets. We're supposed to be ready in case they attack Eurus, even though it would take them 14 months to get here. It's ridiculous, but I'm afraid we'll have to turn off all the lights. Perhaps we could go out onto the terrace.
Oh, what a lovely idea, Sayo. I'll have our dessert brought out.
The stars are out tonight. And there's Anaris.
Oh, you know, we call it the moon.
On Anaris, we think of Eurus as the moon.
Do you really believe in free love up there?
Free love?
Drea, behave yourself.
No, I don't mind answering questions about Anaris. But what do you mean?
Well, you just hop into bed whenever you feel like it. You don't even have to be married.
Ah, yes. Well, in a sense, people can copulate whenever they wish. They can ask for a room in a dormitory for a single night, or they can become partners and stay together forever.
Hmm. Your, what do you call it, your, partner? Did she let you have her before you were sworn to her? I mean, didn't she want to keep her honor?
The first person I actually lived with was another man.
Oh, that's disgusting.
Dr. Shevik, please excuse my wife. I'll attend to her later.
Please. I am the first person to come from Anaris in 200 years. I'm sure you have many strange ideas about how we live. People on Anaris are free to copulate with whomever they choose.
Hmm.
There was a time in my life, just after the first edition of The Principles of Simultaneity had come out.
I remember we received a copy of it here. The title page said Sabul and Shevik, but we could tell it was all your work. Sabul had never been able to think so brilliantly.
Yes, Sabul appropriated my ideas. I felt completely alone. One night, I came across an old friend, Badap. He came back to my room, and we talked for a long time. Badap is an educationist, and he, too, was having trouble getting people to accept his ideas.
Dap. What went wrong with this planet? What's going to happen to us?
I don't know.
Badap, stay with me tonight. Please.
Put your arms around me. I'm frightened, too.
Badap, I don't want to go on like this.
It's because I'm fat, isn't it?
There's a group from the Science Institute. They're going hiking in the mountains. I'm going with them.
When you get back, I'll be gone.
Dap, I do still love you.
I love you too, Shevik. Don't freeze your ass off in the mountains.
Following me.
Your name is Takra.
Yes. What do you want?
I just wanted to tell you, I have never been drawn to a woman the way I've been drawn to you ever since we started this hunt.
I didn't mean to spoil your vacation.
Well, it doesn't spoil it. It's like living through an earthquake.
Oh, thank you.
Well, it's not you. No, it's me.
That's what you think. If you wanted to copulate, why haven't you asked me?
I'm not sure that's what I do want.
I'm not sure either.
You've sworn off sex?
No.
You were at my going away party in North Setting.
Mm-hmm.
It was 2 years ago and we danced together, remember?
Yes.
Later on, almost morning, we talked about people facing up to pain.
Yes. I remember that night very well. You said that suffering, not love, is the thing that gives people the strength to stay together.
Yes. Takva, what are you looking for?
I'm not against pleasure, but I don't need it. And if I take something I don't need, I'll never get to what I do need.
What do you need?
I need the bond. The real one. body and mind and all the years of life. Nothing else. Nothing less.
Yes. Body and mind. For life.
Ah, the all clear. Eurus is safe for another night. Well, I must go inside and see what the servants are up to.
Did you really talk about pain and suffering with your partner?
I did indeed.
Oh. You must tell me more. Take my hand, man in the moon.
Yes?
Now, press it to your lips. Now we will meet again.
Dead on! Just what you said it would be, Dr. Shevek.
Yes, but there is one final connection I cannot make. There is a wall, and I can't seem to go through it or around it.
Dr. Shevek, it's for you.
Hello.
Hello, man in the moon. It's Drea Pace, Nyar's wife. You came to our house last weekend. Have you forgotten me already?
No, of course not.
You pressed my hand to your lips.
I have a partner on Anaris, and your husband is working 10 feet away from me.
Oh, do you really think Sire would object if you and I had lunch together?
Lunch? Oh, I thought you meant...
Well, you can explain what you thought I meant over lunch. Candra's Cafe in the Pearl Market.
And what would please the palate of Madame Drea today?
Baby shrimps marinated in the Carnassian style.
Sir?
I'll have the thing, whatever it is.
May I suggest a light dry wine, sir?
Oh, he never touches alcohol. He's one of those terrible Adonians from Anaris. But I'll take a double glass of your best sparkling.
Very good, Madame Drea. Pleasure as always.
Well, here you are. Oh, but you look so stern, Dr. Shevek. Have you come only to scold me for interrupting you?
No, of course not. It's just that everything here is so rich.
Now, you mustn't think we are all bad, silly people. We have earned our little luxuries. You know, my mother was a chambermaid. She worked 12 hours a day so I could go to finishing school and mingle with the right people. Learn to use your brains, my mother told me. And so I did. I seduced Sayo in his own father's bedroom, and then I got him to marry me. Sayo's family has had money and land for 17 generations.
I see.
Dr. Shevek, I am not accustomed to having lunch with scowling old men.
And I am not accustomed to being with women who are bald.
Well, all upper-class women on Eurus shave their heads. The more skin men see, the better they like it. But then we sprinkle our heads with these powders that give different effects in the light.
It is very, very attractive. May I ask you something? The diamond at your throat, how does it stay on?
Oh, a magnet. Implanted under my skin.
Amazing.
You disapprove of me so thoroughly. I love it. Would the stern anarchist like to give me a spanking?
What is that?
You'll put me across your knees. Slap my bottom. Don't they spank children on a nurse?
They certainly do not.
Oh, Sayo likes to spank me. Sometimes it's very exciting. You know, but sometimes Sayo really is mad at me and it hurts. But I always forgive him afterwards.
On my world, people do not hit each other to show their affection.
What do they do?
They copulate.
Oh, yes. And so you've told me. Well, life is so pleasant on Anaris. I can't imagine why you came to Eurus.
I have work to do here.
Yes, but that's not the only reason. You are attracted to the way we live, but you don't want to admit it. Whenever you find yourself actually having a good time on yours, you draw yourself up like an angry old war horse and say, oh, but these people are terrible.
Am I really that obvious?
Well, not to everybody. But I'm a very sensitive person.
I do like many things on yours.
Then don't be afraid to show it. Sayo and I are having a party next week. Will you be my guest?
I would be delighted.
Oh, wonderful. Now, touch my hand to your lips again. Man in the moon.
You do have beautiful hands.
Ifor, are you sure this is what people wear to a party?
Oh, yes, sir. Breeches, waistcoat, ruffled shirt.
I feel like a wandering juggler.
That'll be the limousine, sir.
Thank you, Ifor, for all your help.
What's this? A note stuck under the door. Shevik, join with your anarchist brothers. Come to Teal Maida's pawn shop in the old town. Ifor, do you have any idea what this means?
The underground, sir.
Underground?
Anarchists, sir. Your people. Like them that started Anaris.
We must talk about this tomorrow. Good night, Ifor.
Good night, sir.
This outer planets thing is getting serious.
Yeah, if it was up to me, I'd bomb them back to the Stone Age.
Yeah.
Hey, where's the surprise? Drea always has a surprise at her parties.
That's him over there, the man in the moon.
Oh, big, isn't he?
Especially below the belt, I'd wager.
Dr. Shevik, there's one question I've been dying to ask. Do you really believe in free love up there on the moon?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, tell me the truth now. Is doing it as much fun on Anaris as it is on Eurus?
I'm hardly in a position to judge.
Hey, you, Shevik. Yeah, I've been reading about your sequencing and simultaneity business in the newspapers.
Yes.
Now, I'm not a scientist. I'm a businessman, as a matter of fact. And I've done quite well, if I do say so myself.
I see.
But all this nonsense you're spouting about being in two places at the same time...
Not quite the same time.
Well, it's unnatural. Religious mumbo-jumbo. We've got enough trouble with the lower classes here without you scientists making them think they can jump around and get away from doing their duties. Now, if you ask me, I think that...
I did ask you, Oi, and if you monopolize my guest of honor, I shall be very cross.
Thank you for rescuing me. What is this party for, Drea?
Well, to meet the famous Dr. Shevik, of course, and to celebrate female power.
I thought women on Eurus had no power.
Why? Oh, because we don't pretend to be doctors or lawyers or great mathematicians. Look around you, my friend. What do you see?
If you loved me, you wouldn't make such a fuss about your children.
I see many beautiful men and women.
Yes, and what are the women wearing?
They are wearing only skirts.
Yes, only skirts. On Eurus, men go clanking around in their big uniforms. But then... they're helpless before the unprotected body of a beautiful woman. The men rule the world, and the women run the men. It's a very satisfying arrangement.
You may have less power than you think.
Oh, Shevik, you are impossible.
Now, this outer planets thing is good for business.
Shevik!
Atro!
Haven't seen you in weeks, my friend. How's the work going?
Fine. Fine.
I must see you to my other guests.
Shevik, where on earth did you get that outfit?
My servant, Ifor. I asked him what I should wear.
You look like a tropical bird. How are you making out at the light lab? Sayo looking after you, all right?
Come, Dr. Shevik. I insist you dance with me.
No, thank you. I'm talking to Dr. Astro.
Go enjoy yourself, my friend. If you get dressed up like a fancy man, you're bound to get offers.
You are never shepherd.
wonderful, Dr. Shevick.
Well, we're not just philosophers up on the moon, you know. We like to have fun, too.
Sir, madame, a glass of sparkly?
Oh, yes, please.
What is that?
Wine with little bubbles. It's very good.
You're right. It is good. It's like grape juice. Waiter, another glass, please.
Oh, there goes Sayo.
Isn't he wonderful?
I know that dance.
It's called the Gezernik, an old peasant dance. You have to lie on your elbows and kick your heels as high as you can. It's very hard. My husband once broke his leg.
We do that dance up on Anaris.
Look, Dr. Shevik's doing the Gezernik. Oh, isn't he great? Oh, Dr. Shevick, Dr. Shevick, look at him go. Go, Dr. Shevick. Bravo.
Bravo. A bottle of sparkly for Shevick, the best dancer on two planets.
Yeah. Bravo.
Prince, I give you the wealth. I mean the health. The health and peace and friendship of Eurus and Anaris.
Is it true up on Anaris you can stuff a woman anytime you want? Don't have to be married or anything?
No.
Twice
the
university
is
giving you, Mr.
Shevick.
We need a good time to study men in plastic
industry.
Plastic? Is it true women in Anaris go around in overalls and they never have any?
Ah, yes.
Dr. Shevick!
Oh, there you are.
Julia.
Oh, dear. I think you should rest a bit.
The wine.
Oh, yes, I know. You come along with me.
Yes. Yes. Smells in here. Pretty.
Yes, it's my dressing room. Now you just lie down and rest.
Nice press. You rusty women.
No. No, get your hands off me. No, please. Well, you don't understand. I'll call you next week. We can arrange something.
I'll call you later. I understand. I'm ready.
No. No. Oh, damn you to hell. You've soiled my skirt.
So then I said to him, Dr. Shevick, that's your third dessert. And he says to me, need energy, brother. A lot of work to do this afternoon.
Sayo, darling, could I ask just one tiny little favor from you?
After midnight?
Open up. We brought your master home.
Help Dr. Sayo get him into bed.
Is he all right?
Can't drink, that's all.
Dr. Atwell, what are you doing?
Shut up, old man. Not a bloody thing here. What the hell has he been doing with his time? We've got open rebellion on the outer planets. If we had his unified theory of sequency and simultaneity, a fleet of spaceships could take off from Eurus and land out there an instant later. We could crush their goddamn rebellion. And what is stopping us? Just this stupid peasant from Anaris.
He told me earlier that he was blocked.
Yes, you're great pals with him now, aren't you? Well, I'll tell you something. Your friend Shevick better get himself unblocked and fast. We don't have much more time to waste on him. You, old man.
Yes, sir.
You keep your mouth shut about this, or you'll wind up with the state police.
Oh.
man is bleeding.
I brought you a cup of medicinal bitters, sir.
Ifo, what happened to me?
Your friends brought you home, sir. You've got a hangover, I'm afraid.
Oh, I've never felt so sick. What?
If you want a piece of ass,
what is this? Ifo, who are these people?
Students, sir. They've been called up because of this outer planet business.
Students?
Coming across the campus is a collection of crazed rebels from the outer planets. If you don't stick your bayonets into their guts, they'll stick their short arms into your sisters and your sweethearts. Arms at the ready. Bayonets, 2 points to the sun. Easy now. Charge!
Students. Atro, what have you done to me? Ifor, last night, that note, those people you called the underground, I must find them.
Oh, it's very dangerous, sir.
Ifor, I must find the anarchists.
Part 3 of The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin. Dramatized by David Lewis Stein. Starring Gary Reineke as Shevek, Barbara Gordon as Takver, John Swindells as Atro, Phil Aiken as Sayo, Greg Elwand as Badap, and Gilly Fennec as Ifor. With Barbara Budd as Drea, George Buza as Oyi and the Sergeant, and Ellen Ray Hennessy as Nexa. Original music for The Dispossessed was composed by Marsha Coffey. Series script editor is Sandra Rabinovich. Technical operations were by John McCarthy. Sound effects by Bill Robinson. Production assistant, Heather Brown. The Dispossessed was produced and directed in Toronto at Studio G by William Lane. Next week, hear part 4 of The Dispossessed.
another chapter 4 of The Dispossessed on next week's program, The Dustbin of History on WBAI New York. Well, we have time today. The Shepherd is a little short, being a syndicated show. So we have time for a little bit of music. And, you know, I have one of these music players that I carry around with me, and I have it sometimes playing whole albums. But sometimes I like to put it on random play. What do you call that? Shuffle. And somehow the new player has locked in on a few certain albums and artists. Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks being one that comes up very often on the new player. And I noticed that from one of his last, maybe his last studio record, Beatin' the Heat, he had a number of guest stars on the record. So we're going to hear some tracks featuring Dan Hicks with his guest stars. Among the Hot Licks, of course, Fiddlin' Sid Page is back on violin. And, well, I don't know. We don't need to name check the entire band, but we will say that Ricky Lee Jones is along for the ride, along with Bette Midler and Elvis Costello. And if we have time, maybe Tom Waits. So we're going to hear some tracks from Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks until we run out of time. From Beatin' the Heat, welcome to Hicksville.
I'm not afraid. at your left, at your right. But my eyes are open all night. I won't wake up tomorrow. For God's sake, I'm already awake. You can lay out a spread a mile long, or whether you can go soft. I don't want to live that. I'm already fat. My appetite's split to Hong Kong. So you see where I am. I got no bread but plenty of jam. And when I wake up tomorrow, my tears will be bursting the dam. Won't you meet me on the corner about 2:30? Can't you hear me calling you? Ain't there something you can do? To shed a little light, to make it alright, so the dog won't bite and I can sleep all night. I'm in some kind of fix.
Some kind of fix.
I'm a drummer and I can't find a stitch. And when I wake up tomorrow, I'll be forgetting all of my licks. Am I down on my luck?
Down on my luck.
If it walks like a duck, it's a duck.
It's a duck.
And I see myself walking. Over there, someone just dropped a buck. You can put me your ball, or we'll ride through. Give me the house that I choose. Where do I sign to make it all mine? Or did I just say some more made up news? But that's the way it go. There's a steady stream of the door. If I try locking that door, they'll be breaking it down, that's for sure. Won't you meet me on the corner about 2:30?
Can't you hear me calling you? Ain't there something you can do?
Shed a little light, make it alright, so the dog won't bite and they can sleep all night. So you see what I got?
See what I got?
I got some kind of weird ass plot. And I better work on my story. Or at least begin to give it a shot.
Does that mean that there wasn't no clouds up in the sky?
And when the rain comes back and it pours good, does that mean that you finally understood?
So you want to feed your belly, jump into the deli looking for a bite.
And you have a close encounter with somebody at the counter looking for a fight. When that store runs all out of your size, does that rocket your plans up into other skies?
What's the combination of the latest compilation? Does it need interpretation to avoid a reputation?
Can we simplify and make it work?
Time to roll over, see what other tricks you got. Time to move over, let the new guy take a shot. Strike it while it's hot, cause later there might not be any room for thought.
Out of town, but it's not easy.
No, no, no. And every time you look, it seems like they took away the scenery.
Ooh, it's a view that you're not quite used to. But since when did that ever seem to bother you?
Time to roll over, see what other tricks you got.
Time to move over, let the new guy take a shot.
Strike it while it's hot.
Later there might not be any room for thought. Strike it while it's hot.
Strike it while it's hot.
Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks with some great guest stars for our musical interlude. And now it's time for Gene Shepherd here in the Dustbin of History. We try to bring you a never-before-rebroadcast episode every week. And from the Boston syndicated series, that's where we're going today. We're going to hear a show originally played in New York City on September 11th, 1969, and then rebroadcast in Boston a week later on September 18th, 1969. That's the recording date. And Shepherd muses about the smallest particle ever discovered, the quark. And then he talks about a fistfight that happened in the Army, all of that and more. On this Gene Shepherd episode from September of 1969, here in the Dustbin of History, WBAI, New York.
That was terrible, Sneaky. Oh, if there's anything I can't stand, it's sneaky people. I just can't stand sneaky people. Being personally a very forthright, open, honest, reliable, sober, industrious, concerned, deeply motivated individual, I find that I just can't stand sneaky people. And I trust that tonight gathered out there in the underground, there's a lot of deeply concerned, honest, reliable, sober, industrious people. I'm glad to see you out there, gang. It's kind of nice to know that you're one of the good crowd, isn't it, though? Hi, George. Well, just try to hold it back for the next 45 minutes or so. It's not going to be easy, but going to do a real bad show tonight. I must warn you. So don't get disappointed. It's going to be real bad. It's going to be totally bad because it's Friday night and I prefer to indulge myself. Right? Oh, tomorrow's Friday as far as I'm concerned. Bring it up. Don't get mad. Oh, no, no. Wait a minute now. I'm part of the new world. You're way back in your old world. You're living back in the dark ages. I'm serious. You're way back there with the bubonic plague and stuff like that. As a matter of fact, I know perfectly well, if you're going to be old-fashioned, yes, today is Thursday. That's if you're an old you-know-what. If you prefer to be old-fashioned about it. But no person in today's hard-hitting, dynamic, totally hedonistic world will even concede today that his weekend does not start any later than noon on Thursday. As a matter of fact, I saw three executives leaving the station here at 20 after 2 today. One guy had three tennis rackets with him and a set of golf clubs. The other guy had a secretary under his arm. And they were taken off for the Maine woods. I said, what is he? What do you mean, where am I going? He says, it's the weekend. Well, I realize it is the weekend. So tonight, you have to adjust your whole way of thinking. It's, you know, the old linear thinking is out, friend. Forget it about those old days, Monday, Tuesday. What came after Tuesday? Monday, Tuesday. What was that day? It started with an M, I think, came after Tuesday. Monday, Tuesday. I mean, you know, Wednesday, that's it. Wednesday, it was an old day. Yeah, Wednesday, Thursday. This is used to be Thursday in the old system of calculating these things, and it is now actually, the weekend is well underway, and there is another thing you must understand, too, that the weekend does not cease being the weekend till roughly 8 p.m. on Tuesday, what used to be Tuesday. So I know what I'm doing. Let's see. Oh, you made a mistake. Oh, well. Oh, by the way, speaking of mistakes, our engineer Keith tonight says this is the middle of the week, you know, for engineers, it's the middle of the week. I mean, for big people, it's the beginning of the week. You know what I mean? Keith's eyebrows go up. No, Keith, he says, would you please do one thing for me? He says, it's bad enough working the show. And without getting any kind of self-gratification. And he happens to be a practicing sadist. And since he is this, he said, I would like to do at least, if you don't mind, I'd like to be on the controls of at least 3 minutes of really, really mean, rotten, hairy, stinky Jew's harp music. I said, well, I said, after all, you have to think of the listener. He says, well, that's exactly what I'm thinking of. He says, there's nobody that I'd like to get back at more than the listener. And I said, well, all right, Keith, is that the way it is? You know, has it ever occurred to you that radio stations may be bludgeons in the hand of monsters? Yeah, we're using 50,000 watts of secret electronic power to bludgeon your brain into a bloody, gray, massy pulp, you know. Oh, I cry out like the Cousin Brucey syndrome. It just just booms out there night after night. How you like that? All right, you all set in there, Keith? This is for you. All right, here we go. Thank you.
You know what that's good for? Hello? Hello? Gee, did you hear me there? Would you tell him to close the door to the John? There it is. You know what that's really good for? I found it's very important. It's good for the sinuses. It clears them up, get them clinkers moving. And you really do, you know? And, you know, speaking of getting the clinkers moving here, before we get underway here on this somewhat, Thursday night, now, it just occurred to me today. I'm walking around on Lexington Avenue, and everywhere you go, you see these people sitting around. They got the radios going. Everybody's talking about the Mets, and all of a sudden, everybody's talking about baseball. Period. Joe Namath is off the front page, and he is Gonesville. Well, it hit me. You know, it's funny. Here, along come the Jets, and they win the title in their league. And nobody expected them to do it a couple of years ago. At least even last year they didn't, you know, when they went out to do it. Yeah, and now it's the Mets. Now, you know, maybe it's just the atmosphere. Maybe sports is far more subtle than we think. It may be that it's in the air. That the New York's time is here. And, everything in New York wins. Watch the Knicks this year, then. Really? I'm not kidding. Watch the Knicks. New York's stock in the sports world is definitely booming. And it could be. Now, these things, of course, now, again, we're getting philosophical, you see. And today I'm sitting in this place. I'm waiting for my turn to come up. And one of these places, you know, where you have to tell them this is me and my appointment's at 3. And by, you know, 4:30, they're calling you into the office, and I'm sitting in there, crossing and uncrossing my legs and trying to read for the 15th time this 1953 edition of the National Geographic, which is in that office. And yes, it's the resident copy of the National Geographic. Hey, I'm just going to ask another philosophical question, rhetorical, of course. Do people get the National Geographic, or is it only sent to doctors' offices? You know the magazine, the National Geographic? You get it? Oh, for crying out loud. Well, there goes my philosophical question. I never knew anybody who got it, actually. It's a great magazine. Yeah, it's an expensive one. Ain't no cheapie, yeah, I know that. And I figured, you know, the only people who got it were dentists. And they only got old ones. I never saw a new one. I have never seen one less than 2.5 years old. And it's got the same article in it all the time. It's by canoe and balsa wood raft up the Ubangi River. With a gun and alimentary canal, stuff like that. And it shows the guy standing there, you know, talking to the natives on the shore. It says, interesting native tattoos can be seen. And you see, there's more than native tattoos that are being shown in this picture. It's what is tattooed that's interesting. And they never refer to that. But, you know, I just figured I'm just full of philosophical questions tonight. And I'll tell you why. I'm sitting in this office, and I have this copy of the Times I bring in there, and I'm reading it, and here's a little note that says, physicist reports he has discovered smallest particle in the universe. And I kind of like, it's an Australian physicist, see. He says he is, quote, 99% sure that he has discovered the smallest particle of matter known to man. I'm sitting there scratching my knee and they're waiting to be called. I'm thinking about the smallest particle known to man. It's philosophical, of course. Now we're getting into the philosophical areas there, you see, because you can't actually reach out and grab one of them and to hold on to it. Now, it's got a great name. Do you know what the name of this smallest particle is? It's a cute name. It's the kind of a name that you would think it would appear on the Saturday afternoon TV kid cartoons, the name of a funny duck. Do you hear what the name of it is? It's not the atom or the molecule. It's the quark. Oh, it's kind of cute, the little quark, you know, running around there. And, yeah, it's a quark with a Q. And are we having a fun election? For those of you who are outside, we're just having more fun. Now, if you like mud, we're having fun. And mud is, you know, it's kind of a basic thing. People all start out making mud pies and making little mud stuff. And it's only natural that man, when he grows up, begins to throw it. Now, he can throw it. There's all different ways to throw mud. But we are having a ring-ding of an election. And that today I stood out there on Fifth Avenue. There's a gigantic sign that says Lindsay. And that sign was maybe 150 feet high and 4,000 feet long. And I stood there in front of it. And there's all kinds of pictures of the mayor looking dynamic. And he's rising above crowds all the time with the sun trickling down over his cheekbones and his hair glistening. And he's looking off into the horizon, see. And those pictures all look so groovy, don't they? They don't show you, you know, around the back of the building there. He's standing spread eagle in front of this beautiful big building. You don't see the big piles of garbage up to the four-story window there and all the dog stuff, that, you know, all the rest of it. This is all part of Fun City. You just got to expect it. It's all here, the alpha and the omega, the plus and the minus, the Sturm und Drang. And you know, that reminds me, hey, can I interrupt you guys for a minute? You know, a couple of nights ago, I hate to interrupt, you know, the parties that go on in the control room sometimes. We just got to do these shows that we, you know, it's such a drag, I admit. But, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I predicted, now I'm gonna gloat here, and there's nothing more distasteful than a man gloating, and I'm just gonna gloat here. It's been at least a couple of months ago that I said that one of the problems that we have today, and it's a problem too, is that we conceive of sin as sex. People, when they talk about passion and they talk about sin, it's always sex. And almost every Swedish movie is about this. You know, you see this big scene in the second reel there where all these people are wrestling and, you know, it's all artistically photographed with the flashing lights and all that. The next day, Rex Reed says, oh, a darling picture. Well, this is a limited view of sin. And I'm glad to report that Fellini, the Italian director, has followed, obviously, great minds work in parallel, that he has created a movie where the other sins are given their full-fledged run through the thickets. And it's a restaging of Roman Glutton Orgies, his new film. Did you hear about it? Satyricon? And I hear it's just groovy. I mean, there's big pictures of these guys eating live eels. You ought to try that. Yes, live eels, man. Oh, yeah. Oh, they got more than that. You know, there's kids listening. I tell them, what else? They got all kinds of stuff. And it's just, you know, it makes any Swedish movie look like the Bobbsey Twins revisited in color. It goes all the way. Now, sins, of course, come in many sizes and shapes, friends. And I just want to tell you tonight, again, I must repeat, that as part of our public service programming and our public service department has prepared a booklet entitled Are You Sinning More and Enjoying It Less? Or How to Get More Out of the Other Seven Sins? Speaking of sins, have you tried, say, for example, sloth? Well, how about gluttony? You have tried that one. Well, well, we all know about lust. Now, have you tried envy, though? Now, that's a good sin. Well, now, you say, no, you haven't, and you're giving it a value judgment. There is nothing more health-giving and brings the roses to the cheeks than a good, total, completely unfettered, open, and thoroughly realized session of dynamic envy. Yes, it is. We all suppress it. We sit around now. Let's say you hear about your friend Clarence, say, at the... You know, there's old Clarence Donner. He's got the, you know, the rimless glasses. He's kind of fat, you know, and everybody kind of puts Clarence down. All of a sudden, it turns out that Clarence has been having an unbelievable affair with this chick who's a centerfold out from last month's Playboy. And then on top of it, Clarence has just been nominated to be the assistant chairman of the board of the Amalgamated God Company. It's in charge of everything, sir. Well, how do you handle that, sir? And then you see Clarence walk down the street, and magically he has grown 2.5 feet in height. He has a 12-inch waist. He has an Italian silk suit that looks like it was sprayed on him. And he is stepping into his new 4.9cc Maserati. Now what? All right. Now, what do you say? Do you, being a man of the, you know, 20th century good guy type, you say, well, I'm certainly pleased that Clarence is gone. As you know, I always knew that Clarence had it in him. And I say to Clarence, by God, Clarence, go as far and as high as you can go, Clarence. And deep down inside of you, this thing is, oh, look at that. Yeah. You see, the trouble is, envy is largely declared by the FCC obscene. I cannot tell you the thoughts that you think of Clarence without running risks. Now, why don't you tomorrow morning get up and just do it? Stand by your bed and swear about the other ones. Just get mad. Break the windows and kick. Now, this is all philosophical. Now, I understand this is philosophical, and I want to bother you with this philosophical problem. They tend to bug you, right, George? You get all hung up, and the next thing you know, you don't care whether Namath throws another pass or not, and you sit there wondering about stuff you shouldn't wonder about, right? You know, you just get too deeply about, like today, reading about this quark, the smallest particle known to man. Now, the reason I am bringing this up tonight, a very serious reason for this. Now, I keep looking on TV, see, and I watch movies and stuff, and I notice one thing that's always happening in TV, and it's always happening in movies, and that's fistfights. Practically hardly a movie goes by, but what Kirk Douglas doesn't say, you said what? Whap! And the next thing you know, the bar mirror crashes, and they're throwing bottles. Somebody picks up a chair and runs it up, and Claire Trevor gets it in the mouth, and, you know, this fistfight. Okay, how many have you seen in the movies? Fistfights. Oh, probably 250,000 or more, I mean, you know. Now, I'm going to ask you. Now, this is an important question. How many have you ever actually seen in your life? Now, if you were to judge by movies, there must be a fistfight busting out every 15 minutes. You know, remember, any place that, say, John Wayne shows up, there's fistfights. Any place that, there are fistfights in almost every movie, no matter what kind of movie it is. There are as many or more fistfights in movies than there are love scenes. And there's a lot of those. Now, there's hardly any of the scenes that you and I actually live. You know that I have never seen a guy wait for his cleaning in a movie? I spend most of my life waiting for cleaning. That's the truth. I'm just saying that there must be something here. Now I'm sitting in this place waiting for this guy to call me into his office where he's going to charge me $200, you know, to just walk around and put little knobs on me and stuff like that. So I'm listening to this jabbering going on there, and I can hear the screams of the other victims in the next room, you know, the dentist, you can hear that. By the way, did you see the fantastic scene of W.C. Fields being a dentist? Did you ever see his short called The Dentist? It's one of the funniest shorts I ever saw in my life. It is almost as funny as the short that he does called The Barber. There's this scene where the guy comes in to this dentist's office. He really looks like a dentist. That's what makes him so good at it. See, he acts like every dentist I've ever been. He really does act like one. And he's got a white coat, and he's got this lady that works with him. And the guy gets in the chair. In fact, it was a lady got in the chair. And he's going, choo-choo-choo-choo-choo-choo-choo-choo-choo-choo. And he takes out a list, a big, you know, one of these big trays of nut picks that they work on you with. And he looks in her mouth and goes, open wide, please. Open wide. And she opens up her traps. With that, the girl sticks a thing in her mouth. This nurse he's got work with, she sticks this thing that looks like a plumber's helper, see? She sticks it in this lady's mouth that goes... It starts to suck it up, you know? It's going like mad, and he's going... Choo-choo-choo-choo-choo. And he reaches up, and he takes his drill. This drill sounded like a sawmill in heat. This drill roared out. What a terrible sound. It was roaring. And I thought, they have hit it. They have hit the curse of all of it. How many times have you lain on your back in the dentist and you hear that little thing go, And then it gets hot. You could smell the dust of your tooth going up into the air as he's slowly drilling his way into the marrow of your skull bone. Oh, God, yeah. And W.C. just kept on... Interesting. Wow. His drill goes. And he's really like a real dentist. He's not playing it like the Three Stooges would play it. And I sat there. Oh, that is the essence of humor. To play it the way it is. And I'm sitting in this office today and I'm reading about the quark. The smallest particle known to man. And it hit me. The smallest particle known to man. That sounds familiar. Would you please give me, if you can bother Lee there for a minute, she's on the phone with an angry complainer. Would you please give me, if you will, a little Japanese koto music? That is contemplating the naval music. There it is. Very good. Just scoop it out there. That's it. That's it. The purple one. That's good. That's fine. All right. Whatever you have. Don't say we don't have it. Just get what you got and it'll work. Just put any one of those on because, you know, one side of man, and I say it's the most violent side, is not the predator. It's not the predator. It's the contemplative side. It's the side of man that sits there and contemplates the infinite and makes vast, fantastic generalities of it. And I thought to myself, why did I hear the smallest particle known to man? Where did I hear that before? Yes. Yes, indeed. And then the doctor's office faded out. And I see the whole scene before me. The only time I ever saw a full-blown fistfight, just like the kind they have in the John Wayne movies, did not come about in a bar, which everybody likes to think is where the fights happen. Like, arguing over some chick, which is the way they always are in the movies. It came about over the totally nutty, irrational side of man. I wish you now, friend, to look into the incense of your mind. Yes. You see that little old Buddha sitting there with the smoke coming out of his nose? You can hear the sound of the temple chimes, can't you? This man counts those bits of straw and rice, those fish bones and those dried tea leaves of philosophy, and contemplates what it's about. The smallest particle known to man. Now, if you take an atom and you divide it up, it has to be smaller. There has to be small. You can bust anything. And you got molecules, and then you break the molecules down, and then you break the thingies down, and the radons down, and the quasars down, and the protons down, and you're left with what? A quark. Indeed, a quark. Reminds me of the poem, The Hunting of the Quark. No, they picked that name seriously. You think that's a bad joke. It is not a bad joke. It is a bad joke only to those without humor in their soul. You may now remove your seared ashes from the premises. The quark, the smallest particle known to man. That's it. Drift it out now, Keith, and I will describe the scene. Now, the only fist fight that I ever saw, really a genuine one. Now, I've seen guys push each other around. I've seen guys belt each other once in a while. But I'm talking about a real fist fight. Happened in a tent. Now, how many times have you seen fights in the Army? What do they come about I mean, what is a fight called in the movies? What do guys fight about in the Army? Usually they, you know, it's usually James Whitmore. And he's about to fight with somebody like Rip Torn. And there's always the Southern Sergeant played by Rod Steiger. And he's going to show, ain't no Yankee going to tell me how to act toward nobody. What do you say? You know, this is what the fights are always about in the movie version of life. That's a simple fight. It is now 8 o'clock in the evening. It is after chow. Boredom hangs heavy over the company area. So heavy that you could just cut it, if you wanted to, with your trench knife and make little, you know, you can make little balls out of it and toss it back and forth and play catch with it. And I come wandering down the company street, little realizing I'm about to observe a scene. Boy, and in fact, I will be part of a scene, which I will forever never forget. I come drifting down the street. There's mud, the duck boards. Nothing's happening. We've had baked, I believe it was baked salmon loaf, which our mess hall specialized in, baked salmon loaf with dried onions in it. So, that's right. Well, no, Spam was our Sunday meal. That was when we were lucky. We got this baked salmon loaf that came from this Class D rejected salmon that they were going to use for fertilizer down in Mississippi, and somebody said ship it to the Army, so we got it. So we had baked salmon loaf. And the other specialty of the house, which was pickled beets. Now, the combination, I understand, today is not considered as explosive as it was then. But I'll just describe to you what happened. We had baked salmon loaf, we had pickled beets, and we had purple Kool-Aid, known better to the company as Purple Death. We had this drink. It was an experimental Kool-Aid flavor, like fermented raisin or something like that. And we got the whole shipment. So Company K is letting its meal ferment, and I come drifting down the company area. And there's my little tent, which I shared with five other guys. It was one of these pyramidal six-man tents. And it was kind of a coolish fall day like this, a day like any other day. At that time, I'd been in the Army, 100, 150 years, had maybe another 200 years to go. So there was no press. Nobody was working. Nobody was bucking for nothing, because there was nothing to buck for. As a matter of fact, our company, in the entire tour of duty, our company, there were three stripes that were distributed. One guy made PFC and another guy made corporal. And that was the entire TO, outside of Lieutenant Cherry and the succession of toadies that he had working for him as exec officers. And, of course, then there was Sergeant Kowalski, who had every known stripe that was ever given to man. In fact, he was the only nine-stripe sergeant I ever saw. He had stripes that went up around the back of his neck and started down the other arm. And so old Kowalski, everybody has disappeared. It's just us, the EM that night. And I go into the tent. You've got to sort of bend your head down a little bit, and it's dark in there. See, now I sit down on the edge of my bunk. Sitting on the edge of the bunk there, I could taste the salmon loaf. Comes up a little bit like that. Then, you know, there was always an encore. After that, you'd go, another one would come, and that would be the beats. And then there was three beats, you would wait, and then up would come the purple death. And then you'd repeat the succession. You'd go back to the meatloaf again. And once in a while, you'd play a little encore from yesterday, get a little SOS thrown in there. Maybe a little dried scrambled eggs. In fact, our company was so poor at times, they couldn't even afford the water for the dried scrambled eggs, and we used to spoon in the dried egg powder dry in the morning, you know? So I'm sitting there on the edge of my bunk. Just, you see what happens in the Army or any place, like even in college, there's long stretches. In fact, it's certainly, you see it here on the 23rd floor, long stretches where your mind entirely turns off. Your mind has left for Alaska. In fact, it's not even there anymore. Your mind is dead. It's gone. Nothing. Your body is just sitting there. You're not even conscious of your body. You're just sort of a little contemplative music, please, if you will. You're just sort of sitting, see. You're almost approaching one of the rare lotus positions of the true nothingness of being. I mean, your body's not worth looking at now, since it's filled with meatloaf, salmon meatloaf. Your mind has been out to pasture now for, oh, ever since the time you got out of basic. You're sitting there. And I dimly perceive across from me in the darkness is Gasser, sitting on the edge of his bunk. And he is picking his toes, which is, this is a hobby that a lot of guys pick up. You just sit there and you pick at your toes. That's kind of nice. I mean, you got to do something. And Edwards is sitting over on his bunk, and he's doing what he always did, which was polish his belt buckle. He went through maybe 20, 30 belt buckles, just polished them down to the quark stage. Just polish them. We're sitting there, the three of us. Well, in walks Elkins, the company driver, who was a troublemaker. Elkins walks in. Well, he was a troublemaker because a long time before, Elkins had seen a Preston Foster movie about how you should join the Air Force and become a cadet. And he went down and he joined up. And 10 minutes later, they found out that he didn't have any depth perception. And they just threw him into the big hopper, and he wound up driving a half-track. And a half-track ain't exactly a P-51 Mustang. And he never forgot it. So he had reason to be a troublemaker. He always wore his hat, by the way, with a 50 mission crush. He did. He always saw himself as driving a P-51 when he drove the half-track around. You know, he used to do Shondells. And so I'm sitting there. Elkins walks in, and he says, this is how it began. What time is it? Any of you guys know what time it is? Gasser looks up and says, what difference does it make? Well, now that's an on-the-muscle answer. Elkins says, what do you mean, what difference? It makes the difference because I asked. That's what difference it is. I ask what time it is. I look up from my naval contemplation. I can see that the Zinsmeister has now ceased to look up through the hole in the ceiling, which he always looked up through in moments of stress, and he is now looking into the tent. And Edwards has laid his belt buckle down. And Gasser says, if I told you what time it was, Elkins, would it make any difference? Elkins sits down on a footlocker. Says, what's eating you? I said, what time is it? Gasser said, what is time, Elkins? Elkins says, what do you mean, what is time, Gasser? Time is whether it's 8:30 or not. With that, Zinsmeister, and this was a fatal mistake, Zinsmeister sticks his oar in. He says, now, wait a minute. There are several theories about time, men. As a matter of fact, time, according to many philosophers, does not exist at all. Elkins says, are you putting me on? I said, what time is it? Are you trying to tell me that 8 o'clock don't exist? And Zinsmeister says, that is correct. With that, sitting over in the far corner, Goldberg says, what are you guys talking about? What do you mean time doesn't exist? Time does exist. If I can tell you that it's 8 o'clock, then it's 8 o'clock, and if I feel it's 8 o'clock, it is 8 o'clock. And Gasser says, get out. After all, what is time? You got a sun moving around, right? You got an earth moving around the sun. And somebody sometime decided that if we mark off little lines, that would be what time it is. And Elkins says, I want to know what time it is. Is it 8:10 or 8:15? What time is it? Because I don't want to miss that crummy show down at the PX. Gasser says, you're an idiot. It is not at the PX. It's at the Post Theater. Edwards says, now look, you're getting me all confused. Zinsmeister says, some people feel that time does not exist. And Gasser says, well, what do you mean? Time doesn't exist. Of course it exists. But this fool who are here says that it's all in my own mind. And Goldberg says, that's right. It's all in your own mind. Elkins got up and took a hold of Gasser's shoulder and pushed him flat on the bunk. Says, tell me what time it is, Fink. Gasser got up and says, what did you say? I tell you that time is only a thing that is in your own mind. With that, Elkins hit him in the mouth. 30 seconds later, all six guys are rolling around the floor, flailing away. Zinsmeister knocked the tent's stove over. Three of the footlockers spilled open. Gasser's got a bloody nose. Elkins has got a black eye. And Kowalski is pulling them all apart. What's going on here, men? What's going on here? And with that, Gasser says, we're trying to decide what time is. I just wanted to tell you, friends, that that argument was never resolved. And for 2 years after that, it simmered like a terrible fester under the surface of Company K's placid exterior. What is time? Is it on Gasser's Mickey Mouse watch? Or is it in Elkins' poor, sad, disappointed mind? Is it in Zinsmeister's contemplation of the eternal hourglass? Or is it part of the quark theory of the quantum dipole estigen theory of multiple fourth-dimensional time curve space vectors? Who is to know?
Gene Shepherd, original date September 11th, 1969, rebroadcast on WGBH, a Boston radio station, on September 18th, 1969. And that's it for today's program. Hope you enjoyed it. If you did, you might want to visit our Facebook page, simply known as The Dustbin of History. You can actually belong to the Dustbin of History by merely requesting to be let in and answering a few simple questions. So join us in the Dustbin of History on Facebook. And that's it. I'm out of talk and out of time. Coming up next, K-Wave USA with Emerson Unger here on WBAI New York. Thanks for tuning in. Next week, of course, more Zero Hour, Face of the Foe, part four of The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin and another Lost Gene Shepherd program. So join us next week, 1 to 3 a.m., the Tuesday overnight here on WBAI New York. So long, gang.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal. Well, I will come back.
Tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
Pencil. Okay, this is Joe Franklin broadcasting on radio station WBAI.
It's 99.5% all natural and preservative free. WBAI FM in New York.